We're just going to talk a little bit, y'all, kind of like about what's going on. I would say this. I want to introduce everybody to one of my best friends I grew up with. He's not a stranger to just living, growing up in an urban environment. We've been in the struggle together. You know, we've seen a lot of stuff growing up. And he got into this form of work because he wanted to serve the community. And so I just want to present to y'all my man, Sergeant Lawrence Hunter. So y'all, so this is my man. So anything you want to say, El, before we get into it? I know you want to introduce people, me to your the people in your community.
Oh, I gotta get them to come over here first, but thanks for having me on, man. I really, really appreciate it. Can you hear me okay, man? I got the headphones on and stuff like that.
Yeah, can everybody hear them? I just want to get, like, can I get a couple of thumbs up or a couple of hearts if people can hear them? Just let me know, people. Ryan, if you can hear Sergeant Hunter, let me know. So, but let's just keep it rolling, because if they can't hear us, they'll send it. You know, okay, people can hear. People can hear, Lawrence.
Okay. Okay, good. I just got to move my phone. I'm trying to type in at the same time, trying to get people to come over to where we are here. So just a little bit about myself. Yeah, I'm a former police officer. I was a police officer for 24 years in the city of Waterbury in Connecticut. I retired at the rank of captain. And I retired after 24 years. I now host a podcast called Captain Hunter's Podcast. I was hoping to try to get this to be recorded. It should be recorded in your end, right? Because I want to get this. I want to get this on.
It's recorded.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So just make sure you send me that, please. Okay. So I have a podcast called Captain Hunter's Podcast. I talk about community issues, police issues, and all kinds of stuff like that. And I focus not just around the Black community. I've done episodes about what's going on in Puerto Rico. I've done episodes about what about this COVID virus and how it's affecting the Asian community. So I talk about obviously black community issues. So just anything that has to do with community issues, any type of community issues and police issues. So that's pretty much about myself. I did retire, like I said, last year, 2019. And that's what I've been doing pretty much is podcasting, trying to get this word out, started a business, trying to help people take a police test and get promoted and move up the ranks and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of what I've been doing.
Okay, good, man. Good. So everybody, we're gonna actually talk about George Floyd's death, y'all. We're gonna get right to it. But this is the thing I want to say is that when we thank you, Pastor Laurel and Pastor Tara. When we talk about this, man, we have to I just showed you like a stack of books, y'all. Y'all just know I'm more of a book, man. You feel? So, but I don't need to keep being codependent. I don't need to explain that to y'all. Y'all know I'm trying to work it. But this is the thing. We're not only going to talk about the situation that happened with his death, but we're going to talk about just the systemic issues that are going on. Issues of institutional racism, issues that deal with policing, just the atmosphere that's cultivated in different precincts and different departments. We have to talk about these things because we have people that deny that these things exist. You know, I'll never forget one of my favorite cartoon characters, Master Splinter, said, right? And he said that. He said, you can't deny the truth just because you don't want it to be the truth, basically. He basically said that people don't want to embrace the truth. They deny that certain truth exists just because they feel a certain way emotionally about it. And I'm going to tell you, that's the exact thing that's going on in a lot of these circles, especially within a lot of these different sectors. And I'm telling you, we have to deal with this stuff. All right. So we can talk a little bit about this, man. We all know that this brother was just basically, I'm being honest, man, he was murdered. He was killed at the hands of police. It was a poor job. They had no consideration as it relates to his health issues. And there were people there that was taping. They were telling them to say, look, let up on this man. You get it? We know that even if he's guilty of whatever crime, it doesn't constitute for him to die like this, you know? And no matter how you put it, they did a horrible job. They were careless. They were inconsiderate. There was a lot of things that went wrong with this picture. And, And I say it all the time, man, it doesn't matter who you are, what background you come from, issues like this need to be dealt with. And because of that, y'all, there's a lot of highly racial tensions that are going on in our country, in our nation, in our society, in our own community. You get what I'm saying? So it's just a blessing, Lawrence, to have you up here to talk with us about this and, you know, just to get your take. And then, you know, you can answer a few questions if people have them, because I want to talk about what happened, how they could have handled this a lot better. And then just even talk a little bit about just, you know, just the possibility or the percentage of this kind of atmosphere that's going on within these departments and precincts. And what can we as citizens and civilians do about this? You get what I'm saying? So, and one more question I would ask too, is there kind of like any form of legislation or laws that are designed to protect civilians in this situation? You get what I'm saying? So just let's make it happen, man. Let's talk. So
let me start off with number one, I'm in agreement with the egregiousness of what happened. And you know, there's really no excuse for it. I think that I think timeout has come for the different types of excuses that people are making around this type of behavior when it comes to law enforcement. And no matter how much resistance, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, no matter how much resistance is given to any type of situation, very rarely does that level of resistance call for the death penalty, right? Unless an officer is in grave physical danger and about to suffer some serious physical injury, and that is defined differently in different states, and or facing the death, then the officers have no justification for the use of force. So let me for the use of force when it comes to use of deadly lethal force. And so what happens is that there's a number of, you asked about laws and legislatures and things like that. There's a number of court rulings that govern the way that police officers and or agencies of the state can act in certain situations. And there's a number of them, but I think the most important one that we should keep in mind for this discussion is the one called Graham versus Connor. And I'm not going to get into the nuts and bolts of it.
Okay.
But just from a layman's perspective, this was a United States Supreme Court case. It went up all the way to the United States Supreme Court. For anyone who doesn't know, you know, something happens on the local level. Somebody gets arrested. They don't like the outcome of it. And they appeal to the appeal process and go up the court's chain of command. And of course, the Supreme Court is the highest court in the land, right? So this went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And in this particular case, the outcome of the case was that what we can understand is that the court said that anytime an agent of the state, and I'm saying agent of the state or police officer, uses force, that force has to be reasonable to the amount of force that is used against him and or trying to escape. So what does that mean? So what that means is if I, as a police officer, am trying to take you, Pastor Stacey Jones, into custody, and you just kind of ball up and say, listen, I'm not getting arrested, I can't then ball up my fist and start beating you in the head. I can't take out my baton and start beating you in the head because your level of resistance at that time is not being met by the amount of force that I'm applying to you. And so that is the essential standard that police officers, corrections officers, FBI agents, and everyone who's a state actor has to keep in mind. Now, in this particular case, I'm going to be very honest. I'm at the point where I'm very kind of triggered at this point in time. We just had the Ahmaud Arbery shooting, and I broke down that video on my platform. And so it's difficult for me to watch these type of videos. Because even though I did it for a number of years, and I did watch some of it, I'm not going to say I didn't watch any of it, but it's very difficult for me because part of my career, I was a use of force instructor. And so that means that I trained officers on the correct amount of force that they could use and be justified, right? As I just tried to explain to you. So I did that. That was my job. I did it for 3 years. I did that. And so, so it's very difficult for me to watch officers who don't, for whatever reason, follow this rule that they have been told. I can guarantee you that this Minnesota officer is very well versed and probably understands Graham v. Connor and Tennessee versus Garner and Terry versus Ohio and all kinds of different court cases that have been going on that guides their use of force. And so what was going on in this officer's mind and in the other officer's minds, I do not know. I can speculate, and I think I have a great degree of expertise when it comes to speculation. But it's very disconcerting. It's very disheartening that we continue to have this. And as you and I were talking, Stacey, before, before we decided to do this, is one of the biggest things that this reminds me of and reminds many people of, and even the Ahmaud Arbery situation, as Ahmaud Arbery down in Georgia reminds me of Trayvon Martin down in Florida. And this particular situation with George Floyd reminds me of the situation that happened in New York when the officers were acquitted. And so it's very, very disconcerting, very disheartening, because it's in my mind, if in the situation that happened in New York, if the officers would have been found guilty or even indicted, right? The New York District Attorney's Office, a grand jury, didn't even indict those officers. And so if they would have been indicted, it's my opinion that they would have that would have sent a ripple effect throughout all of law enforcement. And so when somebody says, I can't breathe, if an officer is dealing with a suspect and they say, I can't breathe, then the officers would take a very different course of action. And so I truly believe that in the case that happened in New York, if they would have been convicted in court, that would have sent a ripple effect throughout all of law enforcement. And this situation that we had right now, when this brother, George Floyd, was on the ground saying, I can't breathe, that it would have been a very, very different outcome. And it's very disheartening because I have sons who are Black. I have a daughter, and I'm often reminded of Sandra Bland. And I'm tired of watching videos in which officers are going above and beyond the call of duty, above and beyond the reasonableness and the use of force, and people are dying. And even more sickening and disheartening is I'm tired of officers getting away with this. And I'm tired of people making justifications for situations in which they know if it was their loved one, that they would not tolerate that. They would not tolerate that from the police, and they should not tolerate that from the police. And so I'm very, very disheartened from that.
I have a question to ask you, and I thank you for sharing all of that. So you're saying that you believe that if on more of the grand jury, if they would have kept them accountable, you feel as though that would have been at least a ripple effect, or it would have been in their subconscious mind that I can't use this level of excessive force, knowing that if someone would die in my custody, right? You believe that they would have second thoughts. So you believe that this breeded this whole systemic issue all across the country, the dealings of how police deal with people of color. So you believe that had something to do with it?
I think that was a continuation. When we're talking about the Eric Garner, it was kind of slipping my mind, but we were talking about the Eric Garner thing.
Yes.
Right. So what I'm saying is that this has been going on. I'm not saying this situation started in, I believe it's 2014 with Eric Garner. I'm not saying that. Okay. What I'm saying is that it was a continuation of the slave patrols and the turning on the water hoses in the 50s and 60s and right. All this kind of stuff.
Right.
I'm saying that there was a continuation of it. And I'm saying that in 2014 was a chance for this, with the video cameras and the numerous times that Eric Garner said, I can't breathe, if a grand jury would have said, would have found an indictment and then there would have been a conviction, it would have stopped this type of behavior by this officer. Because in the officer's mind, it would have said, oh, you know what? This guy can't breathe. I remember another case where the guy can't breathe. Right. And those cops went to jail. And so let me let this guy up. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying it would have and should have triggered something in his mind. But because the officers got, I'm speculating. I'm doing a lot of speculation. I'm not saying that this is fact. I have not talked to the officers. I'm not a mind reader, or I'm not a psychologist or anything like that. What I'm saying is that I believe that it would have created a ripple effect. I believe it would have caused and gave officers caution and pause. And when the courts did not find those particular officers not even guilty, they didn't even indict them, then that caused and perpetuated this problem. That's what I'm saying.
I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. And that's a good point that you make in regards to that. So as a police officer for over 20 years, okay, for those who are just tuning in, I'm speaking to one of my best friends, Lawrence Hunter, who served. He grew up just like me in an urban environment. He grew up in the inner city just like me, and he wanted to serve in this context, y'all. He has a heart to serve the community, okay? But serving in this context, can you say that there are, and I know you weren't a part of, you know, every precinct in the New York metro area, New Haven County. I know that would be foolish for you to speak on behalf of that, but you can acknowledge that there's a good portion of precincts and departments that that cultivate environments where it's okay to use excessive force even when it's not necessary. There's these systemic issues. There's institutions. There's institutional racism. There's these environments that are designed basically not to really care for those who may be considered marginalized or oppressed, right? Can you say that there's environments, there's departments, there's precincts that are designed like that where people show no regard for people, and a lot of it has to do with the lack of diversity and the lack of people in certain positions that keep them accountable? Can you say that?
Yeah, I cannot say that there are departments that are going out there intentionally doing that. There's 18,000 police departments and or police agencies, sheriff's departments, mm-hmm. combination, whatever. Mm-hmm. And they range from one or two officers all the way up to, you know, the bigger, largest departments, NYC, LAPD, you know, with mm-hmm. thousands of officers, 40,000 officers or whatever they have. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that, and I don't believe that officers, I don't believe that that there are departments who are intentionally doing that. Now, when those departments are found out, i.e. Ferguson, Missouri, where we know that those officers were targeted, where the officers were targeting Black citizens, we know that because of emails, we know that because of testimony, we know that because there was a Department of Justice or DOJ investigation. So we know what was going on in those. And so we know that in some departments, there are what's called consent decrees. And what happens is in the terms of consent decree is a police department will be under the gun, or a sheriff's department or some type of localized agency will be under fire, under pressure from the citizens, right? There's things going on. People are complaining about excessive force. There's beatings. There's no transparency when it comes to police uses of force. If you try to file an internal affairs investigation, you get blown off. And so when people would complain, and then therefore
so that does happen. So that does happen. So you say that people will get blown off, and as they're trying to seek to find out the truth and more information. So you say that stuff do happen.
I am going to say that, and I'm saying that because there's been investigations where this has been revealed. Now, what we don't know I'm not going to say what departments this is going on at. What I am going to say is when there have been investigations, i.e., Chicago, Cleveland, I think Trenton, East Hartford, Connecticut, Seattle, Washington, all right? And there's been departments where they have called Baltimore, these consent decrees. And what happens is the DOJ comes in and the police, the feds, and the city government will all come together and say, okay, here are the reforms and here are the changes that we're going to try to make. We agree that there are some problems and we're going to make them. So there's an agreement going on that at the very minimum, what we can say positively is that some type of change needs to come on. And so, you know, how many departments there are, I don't know. You asked a question about racism and things like that. And so let me try to address that for a little bit. We don't know how many officers are racist. Right? Once again, you know, there's probably, a million officers
right.
Working in these 18,000 departments, you know, give or take or whatever. And so we don't know who harbors ill feelings towards persons. We don't know. We try to get a sense of it in good progressive departments. Will fire officers who are acting inappropriately or who are members of illicit groups, or if they're found out to have some type of racist memorabilia or racist ties or racist Facebook posts, et cetera, those officers are usually fired. So it's very, very difficult to find out who harbors ill will. And also, let me, if I can just say something, I want to be very clear about this. A lot of times, what I think the biggest problem is something that we try to tackle, and that is implicit bias. And the implicit bias is when there's a animus or prejudice that is unconscious, right? So if I'm a racist, right, if I just don't like, I'm a black person, obviously, if I just don't like white people, and I join Facebook groups that says I don't like white people and all that kind of stuff. I'm a member of the New Black Panthers Party, I don't even know, or whatever. So that would be explicit, right? I'm voicing that. I don't like that. But the problem is there implicit bias. Implicit bias is when I have these prejudices, and maybe I'd say I'm not a racist, but I act upon them, right? And so maybe I don't like, and implicit bias isn't just about race. And I was also an implicit bias instructor. And so when I taught implicit bias, I would say that a lot of times, implicit bias is not just about race. So let's just say I'm a police officer, and for some reason, I just don't like big fat people, right? I just don't like them. So every time I pull over someone who's on the heavier side, I give them a speeding ticket, right? And I don't give them to the skinnier person, then I have an implicit bias against heavier people, if that makes sense. So a lot of times what happens is in these cases is people are acting out these biases that they have, and they don't realize that they have them, or whatever. I'm talking about implicit bias. I'm talking about people who if you ask them, they would say, oh, I'm not a racist. I believe everybody should be treated equally. And I don't know if that's the case in this particular officer, bringing back to George Floyd. And I don't even know the race of the other officers. I did see that there was one other officer who was of Asian descent who was also terminated today. I believe it was terminated today. So, you know, this problem that there's this anti-Black bias that keeps coming on to people is problematic. And that is what needs to be addressed. And that's why I want to bring it back to implicit bias. I don't know. You can't just look in this guy's locker, the officer who was fired, or who had the knee on his guy's neck, and say, "Oh, guy," and just say this guy was a racist. He may never had a racist bone in his body. I understand he may have coached his kids' little league softball team or whatever, and had black kids on there. I don't know. What I'm saying is that why I'm comfortable talking the way I'm talking is because we understand that there is a bias that is against African Americans. And here's what I'm saying. I can guarantee you that if this guy was in the more affluent part of Minnesota and he had to take into custody a more affluent white citizen or even a white citizen, and this guy was saying, I can't breathe, or he knows he's being videotaped and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the other points that we can add to it, I can almost guarantee you that this situation would not have happened. And that's where I'm comfortable talking about.
Almost definitely. It would not go down if we were in Edina. It would not go down if we were in even certain parts of South Minneapolis. It would not go down if we were in St. Louis Park. And if there was one of my white brothers and sisters, that's just the reality that we have to face. You get what I'm saying?
Right.
I'm gonna be honest with you, Lawrence. I think that implicit bias is one of the leaves that come from the branch of racism, though. Believe it or not.
I'm not doubting that at all. I'm saying that we all have them. Yeah. No, I agree with that.
Right. And not the unique, but the crazy part about it is that sometimes there are people who are walking around and saying, I'm not racist, and they don't even realize that they are. There's covert racism. There's overt racism. There's different dynamics to this whole piece of what it means to be racist. And whether we realize it or not, a person that grew up in privilege and has a biasness, they don't realize that's a representation, man, of being racist. And a lot of people don't realize that. So when you start to talk about this, right, they're so quick to attribute just the current situation they're in. Or, you know, I've even heard people like this before saying, you know what, man, I can't be racist right now because, you know, my son has friends that are racist. My son have friends that are African-American. Or I would say that, my daughter, she's marrying an African-American we're accepting them into the family. You understand? It's kind of like people have these different deeds to justify that they're not racist. But at the same time, you know, they have these different issues within their hearts that they're not aware of, you know what I'm saying? And they walk these things out on a daily basis. And that's something that people are refusing to acknowledge right now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So right. It's kind of like, man, you know, if you're saying that you're not that, the question is, what are you doing actually to actually even deal with these issues that are going on? You get it? Sometimes you could just tell just by the feedback that the people have that shows their level of insensitivity as it relates to these issues that we're dealing with. You get it? So this is the question I would ask then. With that, with all of that, Lawrence, what are some of the things that we can do as just citizens as relates to kind of dealing with these issues, man? Because, you know, right now, Lawrence, there's a huge protest going on a few blocks away from where I live. You know what I'm saying? It's on the south side. All I got to do is cross this, get on the highway and go a few minutes, man, about 15 miles away. I mean, 15 minutes away. What can I do? What can we do, you know what I'm saying, to kind of like start combating this stuff, man? I know there's a lot of things we could do, but just can you articulate some of the things we can do as it relates to, you know?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, in all honesty, I got to say that I think that in this particular case, that the administrative staff of the Minnesota Police Department and or the city acted fairly swiftly. You know, I believe this incident happened yesterday and they're fired as we speak, right? So.
But can I interject with a question? I just want to interject with a question. Why couldn't they get arrested? Why didn't they arrest them?
Well, that may be coming. That may be coming. So this is a more difficult question as far as talking about the laws. You asked me about the laws and things like that. So what happens is that, you know, police officers are, for lack of better terms, they're given this benefit of a doubt that they're acting within the color of law and that they're that the deeds that they're doing are justified. I mean, that's kind of this unwritten social contract. Right. And until we find out that what they've done is overstepped the bounds. And so I'm sure that their arrests will be coming with probably tomorrow, in all honesty. Really? I'm going to assume that. There has to be, and so you ask what we can do. What has to happen is there has to be a lot of patience. People think, okay, this happens, and you know, situation X happens, and then officers should immediately be arrested. That just isn't the case because of what I said. There's this social contract that officers are given this great deal of, I don't want to say immunity, but they're given this great deal of deference in order to act and carry out their deeds. And until and unless those deeds are found out to be egregious, over the board, stepping over the bounds, which we are seeing in this matter, then we have to, then they have to act. So another thing that people have to remember is that, I know this is unpopular to hear, but there has to be an investigation, number one. And number two, that the videos that we see is not the end all and be all of the story. We saw one view. And so there has to be multiple views, multiple witnesses spoken to, multiple officers who had to be interviewed. And so this is the part of the due process that is afforded to officers. And in reality, really is or should be afforded to all citizens of the United States. And because a police officer is acting within a color of law does not negate their constitutional abilities or constitutional rights.
I think, this is the question I would ask then, is we talk about the whole due process for police officers. I just realized the question I would ask, why isn't that same due process applied to like citizens a lot of the times? Like, I'll give you an illustration. Like, for instance, I never forget, like in 98 or something like that, right? You know me, I'm like what, 5'10 and a half, 5'11 on a good day, right? Right?
So when of course,
I gotta put that 5'11 in. I gotta put that 5'11 in, right? And when it was during the time I was playing college football, right? And I can say this, I was weighing about 175 pounds of muscle back then, right? But check this out. So I was just walking into my apartment. I was single at the time, right? I had on jean shorts and a gray shirt, right? And a police officer just stopped, walked up, right, literally tackled me, threw me against the car and said, you know, I'm about to be arrested. I'm about to go to jail. And I was like, what for? You know what I'm saying? And it was just some whack situation that happened, right? And then if it wasn't for the lawns person, the caretaker at the apartment that came down and said, what are you doing? That's not him. Furthermore, the lady that kind of runs the office came down and said, you know what? You're crazy. This guy mentors my son, right? The lady said, well, he fit the description. I said, what's the description? 6'3", 250 pounds. So I'm like, okay, oh, I fit the description, right? So like I said, I'm 5'11", if on a good day, right? 175 pounds back then, right? On, you know what I'm saying, give or take, right? But the thing was, it felt as though that they found out there was something that was going on. And I'm just asking a very elementary question. Why couldn't that be like a due process situation? I mean, this is something that someone would ask. I'm just asking that question. Why, like, my arrest was going to be automatic. I didn't fit the description. You know what I mean? It, you know what I'm saying? There would have been a huge issue versus, and then when I confronted her, you get what I'm saying? Oh, she's like, sorry. You get it? So I'm just trying to figure out, do you feel like that exchange or that system in place is fair? Because it's kind of like, man, bro, it's like, it seems like there's a long drawn out process for officers. You get what I'm saying? But it just seemed like a person that's, there's just speculation that he did something wrong, he's going to get arrested.
Yeah. So I think that there seems to be a lot of inherent unfairness within the system. And I think that, you know, a lot of people feel that type of frustration. A lot of people feel that type of frustration. I'm not going to sugarcoat any of that. I mean, there's a lot of times when officers overstep their bounds. Now, there should be a due process when people are on the street. There's no doubt about that. There should be a due process when you're on the street, right? You should fit the description. If you're 5'11", you know, a 175, and the person that they're looking for is, you know, 6'3", 250, then there's a difference there. There should be a little bit there should be a lot of due process when it comes to that. So I'm not going to sugarcoat that. And different officers in different circumstances will see things differently, you know. And so there should be due process. Let me say that. You know, we can go off on these different tributaries and rabbit holes about that, but there should be due process. And we should allow the system to work to the best of its ability. And when it doesn't work, we should address our concerns and our grievances in the right way. And so, once again, I want to make sure that we understand that we got to let the process work.
Yeah,
we should believe in the process until the process shows that it does not work. And in this case, I think that they're acting fairly swiftly. I gotta say they're acting fairly swiftly, and I think it's, I mean, okay, they can protest in the street, they can I don't, you know, whatever else they are doing, they should take those methods. But all in all, if I'm a citizen, when did this happen? It happened yesterday or the day before? I'm not even sure, but I know that within one or two days.
Yeah.
Right. So within 24, 36 hours or so, these guys fired, and I don't almost guarantee by the end of business tomorrow that these guys will be in handcuffs.
Okay.
At least the one or two officers, and the other officers maybe even, man, the other three officers, it's my understanding from what everything I read so far is that they were fired, because they have a duty to act and duty to protect, and they didn't do that. Right. And so that's why they'd be fired. And there may even be some manslaughter charges coming their way. I mean, I think that would be hard to sell as far as a jury trial. But certainly the officer involved in this is probably more than likely going to be looking at manslaughter
charges. And I appreciate that. And L, check this out. So for those who are coming on late, I just want to share a couple of things. My friend, Sergeant Hunter Lawrence, he basically talked about just the fact that it could have been handled, y'all, better than that. And we're in agreement with that. It wasn't cool how everything went down. We're just trying to have some basic discussion on, we talked a little bit about just kind of like some of the, a little bit of history on how if things would have been acted upon early in regards to Eric Gardner's death, right? And I'll even go back and even say this, Lawrence, man, even to the point when the thing went down with Even when the thing went down with Rodney King, I'm gonna ask. We're gonna answer a few questions in a moment, but I'm just saying, just the historical issues of what has happened over the years. I feel, and I believe my community believes too, and you believe too, Lawrence. Like if we would have acted upon it justly early on, we believe that we wouldn't have even gotten to this point. You get it? But the issue is, it just seems as though we're as a nation, we really don't show regard for people of color or marginalized people. And that poses as a serious problem. And then when people want to revolt or fight against, you know what I'm saying, any form of institutions and all that, people take issue with that. And in some aspects, I understand. I'm not, but my greatest desire is, you know, how can we continue to walk this out peacefully at the expense of not making sure other people are not hurt during the process? You get it? Because remember, we talk about the whole thing about Rodney King that ended up in a very violent riot where a lot of innocent people got hurt. And I understand.
Well,
you get what I'm saying?
Well, look again and look what happened with Rodney King. And once again, I would bring this to the Eric Garner case, is that in both of those situations, the officers were caught red-handed, Eric Garner and in Eric Garner's situation. I believe the officer's name was Pantaleo, last name was Pantaleo. And the Rodney King incident, these are incidents that are caught on videotape and the officers are let free, right? In the Rodney King situation, the officers were acquitted in California courts and then had to be convicted in federal courts. And so that's, and then again, you know, fast forward to 2014, here we are again with Eric Garner. So and once again, this is the history. This is what's been going on. This is what's been going on for since the slave codes, since emancipation, since Jim Crow, Jim Crow by another name, and so what can we say? It was going on in the 50s and 60s. Malcolm talked about it when, back in his speeches. Then everybody says, well, not everyone, but a great deal of people were saying that, the African-American community is complaining, this is not going on, this, that, and the other. And next thing you know, we get the videotape of Rodney King. And then everyone says, okay, well, if the guy only would have submitted, right? If he wouldn't have just fought, if Trayvon Martin would not have worn a hoodie or cut through the backyard, or if Tamir Rice would not have been playing with the gun. Or, when is it that the people who were perpetrating these types of crimes are found and held accountable for what they're doing, right? And so that's what's just so disappointing, and really, really am disgusted that we have to talk about this in such close proximity to Ahmaud Arbery. And once again, let me say, I don't think that this is happening. This is not happening in other communities. It's not happening, right?
It's not happening in other communities. No, it's not. It's not, man. It's not. And yeah. I just think that that's an issue. There's no other way around it. And I'm telling you, me and you both know, Lawrence, man, people are tired. You know what I'm saying? And even in the urban community where me and you grew up, this is nothing new. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It happens all across the country. And the thing is, man, for people just to isolate and say these are different, unique situations. No, if I feel as though the mentality, the spirit is still the same wherever you go, and something has to be done about that. Man, there's a couple of questions. One of my colleagues that I went to, I was in seminary with, Pastor Terry Parrish. I don't know if she's still up. She said, can you ask him what might be going on behind the scenes at the police stations? I'd be interested to be a fly on the wall at some of these precincts. So, sis, if you could provide a little bit more information on that question, or do you think you can answer that?
I actually think I understand. What she's asking is what is, at least what I think she's asking is what is the talk? And I can tell you that the talk, the locker room talk, and I'm assuming she's talking about amongst the lower ranks and files, sergeants, detectives, and the regular patrol officers.
Okay.
So they can, and she can correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay, correct.
And, So what I think she's saying is what's the talk? And so the talk is all over the place, right? There's going to be some people who are going to say, you know what, this guy did everything he did was right. What's the problem? What's the beef? There's going to be other officers. Yeah, it's crazy. Oh, there's going to be other officers who are going to say everything this guy did was wrong. You know, I hope he gets, I'm glad they got fired. They should have resigned. These guys are an embarrassment to the badge. And you're going to have everything from all points in between. And as far as the upper higher ranks, you know, that is going to depend upon the attitude of the police department and the chief and the mayor in and of itself. If you have a good department where the chiefs and the assistant chiefs, the deputy chiefs, the captains and the city is thinking along the lines that we're thinking that they want their officers to protect the community, then they're going to be like, you know what, this is terrible. This is wrong. You know, we got to get rid of these guys. And it's my assumption that they are washing their hands of this situation and saying, you know what, these guys are on their own. And that's why they got fired so quickly. They got fired before they got arrested, which is something. I mean, that's something.
Okay.
It really is something, because the city says that the act of firing someone is telling the citizens, telling them that your actions have crossed the line of what we expect of the code of conduct of our police officers and probably many other policies and procedures that they may have crossed along the way. And I can guarantee you that right now that the state police or the district attorney are drawing up the arrest papers. I almost guarantee that right now.
Okay, and that's good to know. So if I'm understanding you right, you're basically saying that the fact that they were fired, because the due process takes a little time, but you're saying the fact that they were fired immediately is a sign that the department is set in a no tolerance zone for that crap, basically. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. They're saying a no tolerance zone as far as future officers' conduct. They're also setting a tone and letting them know that we're not going to stand by you. We don't stand by this kind of stuff. A lot of times when these types of incidents happen, you will notice that in the first, what happened was they were placed on administrative leave with pay, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's union rules involved and all that kind of stuff, and that's part of the due process, which says you can't just go on firing police officers because they were acting within their legal bounds and duties and stuff.
Okay.
And so I'm sure that the chief of police and or someone said, hey, listen, went to the union, said, listen, this is not the one to stand by. And I'm quite sure the union is going to say, this is not the case to stand by. This is not it. And law enforcement generally, and I'm speaking in general terms right here, law enforcement knows that with the Eric Garner situation, they got away with that. They're not going to get away with another one.
Okay.
And I hate to be so. I don't mean it to sound cavalier. I don't mean that to sound capricious or uncaring, but it's true. Law enforcement knows that generally, I'm speaking generally, I haven't talked to all officers, but they know that Eric Garner situation was really, really messed up. It was really messed up.
So they know they fouled
and these
up.
Officers,
so they know they made
them. They know that they fouled up, and they know that more should have happened. And the fact that there weren't crazy riots going on, even though there were protests and all that kind of stuff, they really got away. And they can't do that again. Here's another case of it. And law
same
enforcement
thing. On the neck, baby.
Didn't happen.
The neck.
Yeah. And that's why I'm saying that if Eric Garner's situation in Pantaleo would have been gotten convicted, it would have sent shockwaves to people's minds. As soon as someone says, I can't breathe, whoop, we're going to loosen these cuffs. We're going to take you out. We're going to get you medical attention quickly. We're going to do everything we can do in order to make sure that you can breathe. Right?
Okay.
And that didn't happen. That did not happen. And that's a terrible, terrible, terrible situation.
It is. Okay. All right.
And look at the case and look at the cases of this. Right. So here one thing that I'm very big on is our ability to live and to move freely in this world. That's all we want as Black people. Right. Mm-hmm. To live and to be able to live our life, this American dream, and to move freely. So in both of those cases, yes, there was wrongdoing. Right. Eric Garner was selling cigarettes. Lucy's. Oh, big deal.
Big deal, right?
Does that deserve the death penalty?
I'm going to tell you what it deserved. It deserved for them, if anything, just to take them to Burger King. Take them to Burger King. And I'm being sarcastic. You know what I'm talking about, man. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
One young man walked into the church and killed a pastor that's trying to serve the community and the people. You know what I'm saying? So look, come on now, man. Come on, bro.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
And so, And so this particular case, they were serving, with forgery, right, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Again, okay, he's technically doing something wrong, so we're not trying to justify the police not trying to take him into custody in either case, right?
Right.
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that it can't, that the level, things that police officers have to consider when they're using force is the type of force that's being used against them, the severity of the crime as another factor that they have to be considering. You can't, police officers, if somebody's jaywalking, you can't go chasing people across highways and risking their life because somebody's jaywalking. Chase them another time, right? The severity of the crime does not cannot be the death penalty for forgery cases and for selling loose cigarettes. It can't be. That's not the way that people want to live.
It can't. And y'all, just for those who are coming on, John Velser asked, can you ask the question above about putting the knee on the neck? Just to let you know, John, earlier on, as
I'll answer. Some people came in.
Okay. Okay, but I do want to say this. Can you just briefly tell them just kind of like the level of force that's being used or the level of crime doesn't warrant that level of force? And he was saying in the midst, he basically kind of shared with him the training that you've done for 3 years.
Yeah. So absolutely. And you said it perfectly, is that the police officers have to judge the level of force with the severity of the crime, and also the amount of resistance and or force that is being used against the officer. There is no need in this situation. There's no justification for, once this man is down on the ground, he is now, for all intents and purposes, subdued. There's no need to keep the foot on his neck or knee on his neck. There is no need for that. There is no justification for that. And it was the duty of the, and as I mentioned before, it was the duty of the other three officers who were fired and or a supervisor who shows up to say, hey, listen, let the man up. Let the man up. And listen, I did this. I did this as a sergeant. I did it as a senior officer. Okay, we got this guy. Okay, let's pick him up. Let's put him in the car, right? Because you have to stop. You have to kind of gear the you have to try to gear the use of force and make sure that everything is going smoothly in the way it should be going, right? And so if and when officers are acting, I don't want to say aggressively, but more assertive than usual.
Aggressive.
It's a senior officer, another officer, a supervisor's job. That's their job. It's in their job description. It's in the rules, regulations, policies, and procedures to step in and say, hey, listen, let's this guy up. It's over. Use of force is over. We got the guy. He's handcuffed. Let's pick him up. Let's make sure he's okay. Bring him to the hospital if we got to bring him there, and let's do what we got to do. But that didn't happen in this case, and that's why this man is dead. And that's what makes this such a tragedy, such a tragedy.
Yeah, so basically the neck was a no-no.
Oh, it's definitely a no-no. I can guarantee you that in his use of force training, once you did ask that, I was a use of force trainer for 3 years. And so at no time did we tell people to put your knee in their neck. It was not part of the training. Now, of course, this is Connecticut and this is Minnesota.
What about his chin? What about his chin and his neck? His chin and my neck.
So I can almost guarantee you that the state of Minnesota does not condone the use of force or some type of neck maneuver where, okay, you take him down and put your knee in his neck. I can almost guarantee you that. Mm-hmm. I have not looked at their policy procedures. I have not looked for the state training for the state of Minnesota, but I would be very surprised if that's one of the allowed tactical maneuvers into taking someone into custody.
I got what you're saying. Okay. And one of my other friends, Ryan Daniels, says, in your opinion, are environments that police officers work in healthy? Are there policies in place to deal with work-related trauma for officers so that communities don't suffer their account of leadership failures within the departments?
Yeah, that's a good question. So more and more police officers are getting the mental health assistance that they need. So that is something that's coming. As far as the environments, there is a trauma that is suffered from police officers, or that they go through or deal with, that is coming from seeing the different crimes against humanity. Mm-hmm. I could tell you as a police officer, you know, I've held dead babies, tried to resuscitate them, seen people decapitated. I literally seen people's brains blown out. I can tell you there's a lot of things that police officers see from day to day. And so therefore they do need to detox from that. They do need to get the mental health and mental help that they need in order to deal with that type of thing. I don't think that officers are, number one, paid enough. I don't think that we get enough time off. I think that, 4 or 5 weeks of vacation a year is not enough.
I don't think,
but I think that about all, I think that about all Americans, but whatever. So that is something. And so you have to be mentally capable and fit in order to work in certain environments. And I would hope that in cities like Minnesota or Minneapolis, right? I would hope that in these bigger cities that they have the ability to rotate through different divisions and or to rotate through different assignments, different shifts, and to rotate from a good part of town to a bad part of town. You can't spend your life and career in a bad part of town because you will become jaded. You become cynical, right? So you need to rotate to something that's positive where people are doing better and all that kind of stuff.
I want to ask a quick question. There's other questions that are coming in. Okay, so L, check this out. So, because that's the thing. Like, for instance, where me and L grew up, we grew up in kind of like, y'all, I would say equivalent to the lows, probably in the early 2000s, early 90s, where me and Lawrence grew up. We grew up like in the lows of what North Minneapolis considered. So if that makes any sense to all my people in the Twin Cities. So we grew up in a rough area. And the thing was, Lawrence grew up in that. You get it? And then the fact that when he started serving in this capacity, I remember he used to share with me at times, he said, you know, my desire is just to make sure that people that are coming from the burbs or people that are serving that didn't grow up in our environment have more of a level of cultural competency. And I remember we used to have those kind of conversations and I just said, man, is that's really an issue? He said, yeah, it really is an issue. Because, you know, like when you're young, you're not really as engaged. You know, I've read a lot of books, but to actually connect with people who are part of that culture, you get what I'm saying? So I just wanted to bring that part out. It's just kind of like, for instance, this person that actually was responsible for the death of our brother, man, he lives up in Lawrence, like I told you, he lives in Oakdale, and that's kind of like in like Trumbull, Connecticut, kind of like where we were from. You get what I'm saying? So it's kind of like he lived that far out and he commuted.
Where the officer was from there? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he's not from Trumbull. What I'm saying is he lived out in Oakdale. And it's kind of like, man, it's like about 45 minutes or so, 40 minutes, I think if anybody correct me, but it's just, it's not 15 minutes away. It's not the outskirts.
Right.
It's past. Yeah. And he drives into our community and does policing. And I feel like, granted, there's probably like a lot of general training that they do, but you know, I wonder if there's actual training as it deals with diversity and cultural competency as it relates to that actual particular area, that zip code area. You get it? So do those kind of trainings exist? I think that's the question I'm asking.
Yeah, there's certainly cultural competency type of training.
For certain zip codes, though, in different counties. That's what I'm asking.
Well, I mean, they're not going to say, hey, listen, if you grew up in, I'm just going to call it affluent town. If you grew up in affluent town and now you want to work in inner city, here's how you deal with those type of people. I don't think that they go that far, but they do try to let people, you know, listen, I'm not a cultural competency expert, but what I am going to say is that there are trainings that deal with racial biases, implicit biases. I was an implicit bias instructor. There are cultural competency classes, and there's different number of different classes, all by different names, that would try to get people to understand about working with different people from different ethnic backgrounds and all that kind of stuff. So that definitely happens. But I also want to be very clear in this. You know, I don't want to seem like I'm, you know, coming down very super hard on this particular officer. Well, maybe I am. But I'm not always convinced that the where you grew up at, I'm not saying that, I'm not going to say that because you, once a person grew up in an affluent town, that they can't be a good officer when it comes to working with inner city people.
Right.
Just like an inner city, just like an inner city kid, doesn't mean that I could not work in an affluent town. Right. So I want to be very careful about that. This is an officer who I do believe was had some issues and dealing with the people. So I don't know, maybe I'm speaking on both sides of my mouth, but I just want to be very careful and talk and not trying to paint a broad brush and saying that any officer who comes from some more affluent part of town should not be working in more inner city environment. And that is not the case.
And Lawrence, no. That's not what I'm saying neither. I'm just saying it's just that how intentional are these different precincts and police force you know, departments are really intentional about making sure that people get the adequate training.
Well, that's a good question. So I can get, I don't, I, you, a person can go on to the Minnesota State website and look at the courses that are being, that all police officers have to receive in order to become a police officer, right? Okay. Anyone can do that. Anyone can do that. And I can almost guarantee you that you can look at these different classes that officers have to take, and it'll probably, I would guess, about 40 hours of some type of racial background type of training, racial diversity type of training. I would almost guarantee about 40 hours, maybe more, maybe less. I don't know. But also, let me say something about cultural competency as far as police officers, right? As far as minority officers, I think it's very important that we get minority officers on the board, and I hope that anyone who would see this would want to become a police officer. And try to do the right thing and say, listen, I need to protect my community. I need to stand up for my community. I love my community. I want to be there for my community. And so people should not shy away from that. And I think that because of these viral videos, that a lot of people shy away from that type of thought process, and they don't want to become police officers. They kind of just want to wash their hands and say, oh, listen, none of them are any good, and I'm going to kind of step away. And I think that is exactly the wrong attitude. I think that people from the St. Paul Minneapolis area, from the Waterbury area, for wherever else you citizen or city that you're from, you really need to explore becoming a police officer and do the right thing when you get that badge.
I get what you're saying. So look, man, a few more questions and then we can wrap it up if that's cool. Aaron Caldwell said, under normal circumstances, nonviolent crimes, how much de-escalation should be attempted before any force is used?
As far as nonviolent crimes, I would say that there is no limit. There is no limit to the type of de-escalation that should try to take place before trying to take someone into custody. If someone is a nonviolent crime, let's just say someone goes into a local store and shoplifts a can of beans, right? Try to talk to this person as much as possible before going hands on. And, you know, I had a conversation with my former chief and good friend, Vern Riddick. He's current chief of police department here in West Hartford. And he said, you know, with this whole COVID thing that we're dealing with, that if you have to go with hands on, that you've already lost. And I think that police officers really need to keep that in mind, that if you're going hands on with people, to a certain extent, you've lost. Try to talk your way out of situations. There's nothing wrong. Nothing, you know, I don't know about different departments, but in our department, we get overtime. Okay, if I got to talk to you for 2 hours, you know, let's try to talk and let's try to work this thing out. Especially for those who are more mentally irrational or you believe that there's a potential for violence or whatever. But any and all forms of de-escalation should be used before any type of use of force is employed.
That's good, man. That's good. Okay. And then John Belser asked another question. He said, as a white pastor, what questions should I be asking or conversations should I have? I think that's a loaded question. But one of the things I would say, Pastor John, what's your community like? That's one of the things I would ask you. I would say, what's your community like? Number two, do you have people of color that are mentoring you? Meaning that, are you engaged enough in a community where you can have someone actually mentor and kind of like help guide you through this process? Because one of the issues that's happening in our communities is that people literally who come and serve in our communities but don't take the time to be mentored, that creates another problem. Okay, so from that aspect, I would say, as a pastor, you know, if you're ministering in the urban context, or if you're working in the area of reconciliation, connect with people who are already serving in that context. Furthermore, making sure that they're people of color who are, you know what I'm saying, that doesn't have the same background you may have a different view on some things. Basically, just getting really connected and becoming a student first. Because sometimes even with your questions can be offensive. You get it? So being mentored and building relationships with people enough to know what's the appropriate questions to ask. Because I've been in situations before where people just ask some straight up offensive questions where, you know, me pastor and all, you know, I want to lay hands on them. And I'm not saying with the oil, but I, you know, I want to use, you know, force. You get what I'm saying? So I'm being silly right now, but just making sure you're in that kind of environment. OK, is there anything you would say from more from a police officer standpoint, Lawrence?
Well, I'm going to try to address that from also from a more spiritual aspect as well.
You are? OK.
Well, I'm kind of joking about that.
Okay.
But here's what I would say. I actually think that the white, and I appreciate, I really do appreciate the question. I mean, I really, really do.
I salute you for that. Thank you for asking that question.
Yeah. It's a really, really good question. I think it's a question that more people need to ask. And I think that leadership, as I talked about, the city leadership, police leadership is extremely important when it comes to how to conduct police departments conduct themselves. But white society needs pastors who think like that. And even if you don't, as I agree with everything that Stacey said, but also I think that if you are a pastor of a majority white church, then you need to direct, lead, guide your flock into racial justice and racial activism. I say in my podcast all the time that Black people didn't start this.
Mm.
Asian people didn't start this. Mm. Puerto Rican people, Hispanic people, Latin people did not start this racial, and we're not going to end it. Our protests are not going to end it. Us YouTubing, us doing these type of talks are not, it's not going to end it. What's going to end it is when you go to a birthday party, when you go to Thanksgiving, when you go to Memorial Day cookout and somebody makes a Black joke that you say, hey, what's up with that? Why did you do that? It's going to take more persons getting fired by white power structures, just like this case in the Central Park. I don't know if anybody else has heard about this. This lady in Central Park went off on this Black. She got fired. When I understand reading the news, she got fired today. It's going to take more people who are saying, we are not going to tolerate that. We are sick and tired of how you are treating our fellow citizens. These African Americans are just as American as we are. And when you do it to them, you do it to me. And I'm offended by it. And that's what it's going to take. And so as a leader, as a pastor of the church, I think it's incumbent upon you to say that kind of stuff. And when there are controversial shootings that you know that you would not tolerate in your neighborhood if the police did this, you know that you would not do it. And so I think that's very important. Can I tell another story here? I had a pastor. He wasn't a pastor. I had a brother, a white guy on my podcast. And he was an Air Force colonel. He retired at the rank of Air Force colonel. When he was a major, you know, his son was killed by police officers in Wisconsin. He lives in Wisconsin. And so what happened was, you know, there was a cover up.
Was he African?
There was a cover up.
Was he African American?
He was not.
Okay.
He was a white guy. He was a white guy. And there was a cover up. And so I'm sure that the Wisconsin, I forget the name of the department right now, but they would say there wasn't a cover up. They did everything above board. But he's able to prove through scientific reconstructions of everything like that there was a cover up. So what happened was, you know, he's on my podcast and he's telling me, you know, I thought that all this kind of stuff was exaggerated by the police, by the Black community. I thought this only happened to them. But when it happened to me, and when my son was killed, and it was a cover up, that I realized that this is a problem. Now he goes out of his way to say he's not anti-police, he's not against the police, he's the one, but he just wants transparency. And that's and I thought that was profound of him to say that. But listen, and here's the problem. I had another sister on my podcast who said white supremacy hurts everyone. It hurts everyone. And so for a while everybody thinks that it's good that everyone is you know, the police are there for me to protect me. That's why this woman in Central Park said, oh, she's, you know, frantic on the phone, nothing's happening. Oh, I'm a white woman. She didn't say this, but I'm white and this is going on. This African American is attacking me and my dog, and meanwhile she's yoking up her dog. But what is the thought process of her thinking that it's okay to do this? And so my point is that when you have this supremacist ideology, right? And this is what we talked about before, this covert, implicit bias type of thinking. You have to challenge that and say, this is not okay. Because when the police are used to doing negative things, covering up things, going above and beyond, and criminal, crooked things, then sooner or later, it's going to come to your house. What goes around comes around. So they've been doing this stuff to African-Americans all this time. And nobody said anything. Not that nobody was saying anything. I'm talking about the white community was kind of pretty much quiet. A few voices here and there. But when it happened to this army, to this Air Force colonel, and he said, you know what? This is a real problem that this cover-up is going on. Well, you know what? That same police department was covering up all this different stuff about African-Americans, and nobody did anything. Now he wants to do something. And I applaud him for doing that. I thank him for coming on the show. But this is a problem. And white supremacy comes, and sooner or later it's going to come to your house. It's sooner or later it's going to come to you, right? This whole mess that we're in right now, this COVID stuff, all this kind of stuff. Listen, this is about class, and a lot of it's about race. Who's getting affected, right? The poor people are getting affected. The rich people, Trump is running around here with a mask, not even with a mask, golfing. So that's what I want to say about that.
Yeah, and I get what you're saying. And I want to say, look, my cousin's on now too, Rich McDaniel, one of the baddest DJs on the planet, y'all. He said he loved this conversation, and he's a state trooper. So we talk about these particular things, knowing that, listen, y'all, and this is the thing I want people to understand too. Protesting doesn't mean you're anti-police. You know what I'm saying? Speaking up against issues of injustice doesn't mean you're anti-police. Basically, people are just saying, look, the time has come where we have to do a better job at addressing these issues. You know what I'm saying? A good friend of mine, Pastor Luke Swanson, says, John, you need to name the whiteness in your church. What you cannot name, you cannot dismantle. Ooh, that's powerful. You catch that, Lawrence? He said, you need to name the whiteness in your church. What you cannot name, you cannot dismantle. And this is another friend of mine, and he's a white guy. He just says it just like that. You need to name it. You get what I'm saying? Whiteness.
Okay. Yeah.
You get my point?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That like I said, that we didn't start this. You know, James Baldwin, the great writer from the 60s, you know, said the only reason I'm black is because you insist on being white. Until you say, listen, I'm not white, and all of the stuff that comes with it, then we're gonna continue to have these conversations. I'm gonna just have this conversation about Ahmaud Arbery. We just had it. I mean, about white people being able to go into people's houses or houses that are under construction, walk around, no issues, no problems. But when the black people do it, we're going to get chased and down and shot. That has to be called out.
It does. It does. It really does. And then John Besser says, what community am I in? Like, what community am I in? I'm not sure if I understand that question. Let me see if there's any other questions before we wrap this up. And Lawrence, I want to say, man, this is real good information, man. And I appreciate you being on, man. Just making people aware that, you know, it's a very complex situation. I think one of my friends said something, and I'm trying to find that one. He made a statement. Let me see. Let me just see if I could try to find it. And it was Ronika Ricks. I remember, if I'm not mistaken, I remember we used to call you Ronnie Clemens growing up, I think, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if she's still on. But let me see if there was one statement that a person said, it's not that easy. As it relates to race, and I agree, it's not that easy. Let me see. Dee Dee Samuel says, "You're a police officer, not the judge. Jerry, you shouldn't be dead because you committed a crime. That's why there's jails. This guy didn't have his due process. This police officer took that away from him. Okay. All right. Not disagreeing with that. Anything you want to say about that, L?
No, I completely agree. Yeah. You know, you just listen, it's inexcusable. And like I said before, the fact that he was fired so quickly, it tells you that there's no excuse for this. And they wanted to get ahead of this. So I actually applaud the Minnesota PD and the administration there and the city and the mayor and all that for doing the right thing so quickly.
Yeah. And for those who are tuning in, we're about to wrap this thing up. I seem like we're getting done late, but actually we started late because there was some technical difficulties. I see one of my friends, Coach Larry McKenzie's up here. How you doing, sir? I'm talking to a friend of mine that I grew up with in the neighborhood, Lawrence Hunter, and he served in the police force for over 20 years, and he did, what was the kind of training you did again? Can you give the title to that again?
Yeah, I did implicit bias training. I did defensive tactics. I was a defensive tactics instructor. As a defensive tactics instructor, it was my job to make sure that officers knew how to take persons into custody safely, and when and how much a force to apply at the given point in time. So therefore we had to, part of that training was we had to go over new laws, interpretation of the laws, any different court decisions and things like that. So we had to discuss that. So there was an academic part of the training. And then also, of course, there was a physical portion to the training in which we actually practiced taking persons into custody. And so that was, I did that type of training for 3 years.
And I appreciate
And also I was an implicit bias instructor as well.
Right. So one of the things I want us to walk away with, one thing that he did say was that you don't use unwarranted force, especially on the level of the crime or the supposed crime that was committed. So if a person is stealing a Snickers bar out of the convenience store, there's no need for you to use excessive force on that. You get what I'm saying?
Right. You shouldn't be shooting at this person because he stole a Snickers bar. Right?
Basically, right.
But that's one of the considerations, right? So there's a lot of things that have to be going on in an officer's mind, and that is one of the considerations, right? The severity of the crime. The other consideration they have to take is the amount of force that is being applied against the officer, right? So once again, if you take the same guy who stole a Snickers bar and is using to confront his brother, he ducks around a corner and starts shooting at you. Well, then of course the officer is justified in shooting back.
Right.
So there's this level of force that you have to meet. Yes. But also you have to another tree in a branch, if you will, is you have to consider the type and severity of the crime or whatever.
Right. So we were saying the neck wasn't necessary. The knee on the neck wasn't necessary. And I would say this, everybody, you shaking your head.
Oh yeah, I'm in agreement. The neck is not necessary. And listen, this man at this particular, think about what's happening. This guy was handcuffed, as from what I could see, was handcuffed, or at least his hands are behind his back, and he's down on the pavement. What's wrong with lifting your knee up off of his neck and placing it? If he's still trying to get up and still trying to wiggle, and people do that all the time. I get it. I had to hold people down myself. He's still putting your knee into the small of his back. Or across his shoulders or something like that. We are certainly trained to do that. Put your knee across his shoulder.
That's if he's resisting, though, right?
That's if he's resisting. Right.
Right.
So, but he's telling you he can't breathe. And here's the second time that we know of and that's caught on videotape when someone says they can't breathe and they die in front of us.
That's a problem.
What more, America? It's a problem.
Check this out. I want to say this, and then I have one more question. For some of my pastor friends, some of my colleagues that are watching this, we're in a crisis right now because of the fact that we've been so busy just focusing one aspect of the faith, where we base a lot of our energy and effort on making sure that people are growing in the spiritual aspect of discipleship, where we don't deal with the social injustices that are going on. If we want to reach this generation, if we want to reach the next generations to come, we have to become more socially aware and socially conscious of what's going on. And we have to get involved in civic issues as well. I'm not trying to say you need to take a political stance on certain things, but we need to know what's going on in our communities. And to be honest with you, just get over the mic and just start preaching and doing what we do, which I'm thankful for the tradition that I come from. We have to do more. We have to engage more. We have to talk about these issues, and these are hard issues to talk about. And I know they're uncomfortable, but at the same time, if we want to reach this generation, we have to be willing to engage and deal with these hardcore issues that are going on. All right. My brother's dead now. He's dead. And what will the church do about it? You get my point? And even I'll even say, and I'm calling out even my conservative brothers, okay, that endorse Trump. And I'm not, look, I'm not even talk about him, but I'm gonna say this, okay? What are we going to do? Are we gonna hold on to a political ideology, or are we gonna speak the truth in love and deal with this issue that's going on? This is problematic. This is an epidemic. These are issues that are going on in the community, and we are not addressing these issues. What are we going to do? Because the gospel addresses that as well. That's all I'm saying. We're in a crisis. And to be honest with you, I was talking to my friend right here right now. And I just told him, I said, I'm going to be honest with you, man. I believe that the message of evangelicals after Trump is done in office, I think the message will be shot. It's going to be shot. You know what I'm saying? Meaning that the message is no longer relevant, especially in the communities, because we have people from all across the spectrum just saying, listen, man, you're not dealing with these issues of injustice and racism and all that. You know what I'm saying? So, and I'm saying,
they're just hypocritical. I mean, I think the message is done. Who besides them right now is taking them seriously? I mean, it's hypocritical. I mean, we don't want to get off on these tangents.
No, we're not, because I got one
question. They're hypocritical.
Okay. So this is my question, but as we wrap up, what can we do, man? What can we do? What can we do? And just real talk to them, man. I know that, you know, you served over 20 years and, you know, man, I'm lifting you up. I'm praying for you. You know what I'm saying? But what can we do as just people in the community as it deals with just this relationship piece, man, because it's strained. It's really strained, yeah. Bro. I mean, it's strained.
Yeah. So, first thing I think that people should do is make sure that they are subscribed to my podcast, Captain Hunter's Podcast. This is the type of stuff that I try to deal with and try to talk about. Second of all, I think that there's a lot of things that I really suggest. And I think that we have to become politically active. Make sure that you vote, know who you're voting for, know what your policies are for voting. Make sure that you get out there and vote in every single election, not just the big presidential elections, but vote for school board, vote for your mayor, because these set the policies and procedures and the tolerance of the police department and all that kind of stuff. So okay. It's important to become politically active and politically astute. I think that anytime that there's any type of outreach by the police department, that you should take them up on that. I'm talking the community now, right? So if your police department advertises that they want to have a community day, we'll come out and meet the police officers, you should go. If there's a situation police officers are meet the police officer once again, you should go. If there's a situation where there's a town hall meeting and the police officers are going to be there, you should go to that. You should be involved as much as possible with your police department. If they have some police departments have ride-alongs, do that. Mm. Some police departments have a citizens academy in which they train the citizens as to what the laws are. Okay. And the rules and regulations are the police. So that way, that will give people a better understanding of what the type of training police officers go through and what is and is not a justified use of force, because everything that we're seeing in every viral video is not an unjustified use of force. It really isn't. And so if you get any type of training in that, then you will have a greater appreciation and or understanding of that. A lot of the police departments are now doing some type of virtual reality training for their citizens. So they put a virtual reality helmet on you and have you walk through these different scenarios, and you can see the different types of scenarios that police officers are put through. Now, granted that that's just a small, simple snippet, and officers are obviously trained for months. But that's some of the things that people can do. And I think that we should take every effort to to meet the officers halfway. My show is the tagline of my show is bridging the divide between the police and the communities. So the police have to take a certain amount of steps and the community has to take a certain amount of steps. And if we're going to say, oh, no, we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it. We're not going to do it as a community, then we're not going to get anywhere. You know, right. Yeah. So I think the thing that we said about the pastor is very true. Make sure that you, as a pastor, as a leader, did you engage the people, challenge their thinking, challenge their preconditions? And as a pastor, you have the ability to influence these people. I'll say it again. You have the ability to influence these people. These people, some of your congregants, maybe stone cold racist, maybe stone cold conservatives, stone cold liberals, but you can change the way that they think. Right. And churches are really just based around the for lack of a better term, the group think of all these different people, and you can slowly mold the way that they think. And if a church is really conservative and really, really, then you can kind of gear and steer the way that they think. And if they're really liberal and really trying to do more progressive type of thing, then you can get, you can steer that as well. So as a pastor, you really have a unique position to really kind of hone in and really tap in and help the community bridge that divide.
Okay, good. And I want to say,
so
I want to say,
I was going to ask him, so what do the police need to do?
What'd you say?
I was going to ask you what you think the police need to do.
What the police need to do?
In order to bridge that divide. Yeah.
What the police need to do? I think the police need to be more involved. Let's just say, for instance, man, if there's a rally, you get it? Have police to be involved at the rallies. You know what I'm saying? And just to kind of like be with the people, man. You get it? I feel like different environments, when police basically show their face, it says a lot. You get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I would even say, for instance, man, it'd be cool to see police at job fairs. It's cool to see just police actually just even acknowledging, man, when wrong is done, right? But I it kind of feels as though they're on the political tip with that. You get what I'm saying? I would also even say too, man, even take time. And I do want to say they've made some attempts before. They've had, like, for instance, where we're at, I live in North Minneapolis, where they've had like cook-offs. They have, for instance, like the MPD and the MFD. I think that's how they pronounce the fire department, right? I think that's what they call it, right, Lawrence? So they have cook-offs, engaging the kids. So there's things that they're doing just to stay visible in the community. You get what I'm saying? Figuring out creative ways to stay visible in the community, and then even having I feel like I told you earlier, man, having continual trainings, man, seasonal trainings, basically, man, about what's going on in the community, even allowing people like civilians and citizens to actually do the training. You get it? Not only just experts. You get it? I think it would be cool, man, like if a single mom came in and did a little bit of training. You get it? Or even if a young person, 18, 19, came in, you know what I'm saying, and had conversations and dialogue and led the discussion. You get it? So I just feel like there's those are just practical things they can do as well. So it's not just all like what we need to do, but there's things we can do to actually step into that, you know, but be more open to receive training from people in the community as well, not just experts. You know what I'm saying? Have a person that's son that was brutally murdered by a police officer, right? In cold blood, have them come and give their testimony and how things can change. You get what I'm saying? I want to say this, you're probably going to get a little bit of pushback. No, you're going to, you do have a little pushback, and I want you to check these out. But you know, it's 9:30 now, and I think we pushed our limit. but I think, man, this is good info, man. We could reconnect and keep doing this again. You know, set up another time to chop and build on this. You get what I'm saying? But the question is, Lawrence, can you put down your information about your podcast? Can you type it in real quick? Because people are asking about your podcast.
Let me see if I can pull it up here.
And Charlie, I think you came in kind of late. You know what I'm saying? We covered a lot of ground on this, Brother Charlie Gray. I think you came in kind of late on this. You know what I'm saying? So, and then Nate talked about, yeah, but all these things fall apart when we see their behaviors are totally different when they're doing their job. Hand me a hot dog on Friday and beat the you know what out of my neighbor on Tuesday. I watched that too many times. Okay. All right. So Nate, I think you kind of came in late on the discussion too, didn't you? You know what I'm saying? And y'all listen, as we wrap up, I just want to say, man, I know there's a lot of hot emotions that's going on. You get what I'm saying? But that's the reason why I have my good friend that's up here with me, and we're talking and having, you know, just this discussion. You get it? Because I don't think one approach is going to solve everything. You know what I'm saying? And Charlie, and that's what I said, man. You're coming in late. You said, what did I miss? Police kill us. You get what I'm saying? It's evident that you came late in on a conversation, man. Listen to the whole thing, okay? Listen to the whole thing, brother. Get it? So I put it in.
Yeah.
And I want to say this.
I want you to see it.
And brother Charlie, I want to say this too. I'm grieving too. I'm frustrated. I'm upset. You get what I'm saying? So, yeah, man. Yeah, let's. You know what I'm saying? We all got to work on this. You feel?
Did you see it? Could you check it out?
Yeah.
It's on YouTube, Captain Hunter's podcast. Yeah.
Okay. So you got
it. Let me pull up something else.
Yeah. So L, I will say this, man. I really appreciate this, man. I really appreciate this, man. It was cool just building with you, man. You know, we'd be on the phone hours talking about a lot of stuff, man. And I appreciate your service. You know, we have a long way to go, man. We have a long way to go. And I want to say thank you for not, you know, just justifying any of this stuff. You get what I'm saying? And got a long way to go.
I'm just as broken as everyone else. I really, really am. I'm not just saying that. I'm just as broken as everyone else. It really hurts me. You know, I'm a black man. I have black kids, and I have black friends. And listen, and I don't want to make this racial, but pause for a moment.
But Charlie, listen to me, man. Listen to me, Charlie. And I normally don't do this, man. If you don't know what I'm saying, mad love to you, man. But you don't got to be up here. And I'm just talking on the rail. Because look, man, we're all.
I want to engage people like that, man.
You want to engage?
I mean,
I want to listen to what I'm saying. I want to engage. This is what I'm saying. I want to engage. I'm heated. I'm livid. I'm hurting like the next man. You get my point. But it takes intelligent, encouraging people. You know what I'm saying? That's really trying to do the best just to make sense out of all of this. You get what I'm saying? You think about it though, Lawrence. Not just you. I got brothers. I got cousins in them, man. And they're fighting the system within. I'm not trying to say that everybody's doing a perfect job. You get what I'm saying? I know that, Charlie, policing is historically against black people. Welcome to America, son. Welcome to America. You get what I'm saying? It's against black people, the country and the society in and of itself. You get my point? You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying that your comment.
Wrong as saying that, you know, all white people are racist. I mean, it's just.
I was talking about a lot of stuff.
There's out there. Try to say.
You know what I'm saying? It's against black people, the country and the society in and of itself. You get my point? You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying that you're
bridges.
I'm going to sort through this, you know what I'm saying, on an educational tip. You get what I'm saying? I'm not saying unintelligent. I didn't say that. I just said the spirit behind it. I take issue with the spirit behind it, Charlie. You know what I'm saying? So, Lawrence, do you want him up here? You know what I'm saying? Do you want him up here?
Or
you?
Well, listen, I mean, you know this brother better than I do, man. But I want to talk to people like that because I want to try to change their minds. Because he's saying that, you know, policing is historically against black people. No doubt about that. And he also said something along the lines of, Police don't want to build bridges. Well, clearly that's not true, because they want some. There are officers out there who want to build bridges. I was one of them. And there's organizations. One is called Law Enforcement Action Partnership. It's called LEAP. They want to do it. So to say that there are officers out there who don't want to do certain things, it's just as wrong as saying that all white people are racist. I mean, it's just not accurate.
No, Charlie, listen, brother. I want to say you haven't insulted us. You haven't. What I'm just saying is that in the midst of this, man, let's just be mindful. You get what I'm saying? Let's just be mindful. Like when you come on, even near the tail end, let's just be mindful and just try to gather, the context and the information of what we've been trying to speak on. Because I'll tell you, Charlie, there's a lot of thought leaders that are up here. You get what I'm saying? A lot of intelligent, educated thought leaders, like my sis, Pastor Tara Parrish. She'll break down every dynamic behind it. You get what I'm saying? But the thing is, what we're saying is just that, even in the midst of that, people who are engaging and trying to work, let's talk. You know what I'm saying? Just to come up and just spit historical facts, not knowing the level of conversation. I'm just saying it's not unintelligent, but there's wisdom behind when you approach and when you start to talk about these issues. So I just want to say that. I mean, it's just like a person just getting in another conversation, man, and you just all of a sudden just, a person just start rambling their facts. You get what I'm saying? So I guarantee if you start spitting more information, I probably wouldn't disagree with you. But I'm just saying at the moment of where we're at, what we try to work through, there has to be wisdom behind how you approach it. That's all I'm saying. You get what I'm saying? So, So that's it. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. Okay. All right. Well, listen, y'all, I appreciate y'all, man. And, And Charlie, we need to build. We'll build more. We'll build more, man. You know what I'm saying? This is Facebook Live. You're right. We'll build more. But look, L, thank you, man, for holding it down. I'm done. Anything else you want to say, boss?
Nah, man. Thanks. I appreciate all those people who are asking about the podcast. Please check it out. I also have to do a YouTube. Make sure you give me this video so I can put it up on my YouTube.
I will do that, man. Man, love you, bro.
Thank you.
It's good to see y'all. And y'all, thanks, everybody.
We gotta do this again, man. We gotta do this again.
Charlie Beckett.